Okay, welcome back. This is hour two of Elimination of Bias. And by the way, if you just stumbled into this recording on the internet somewhere, just go to richardklamm.com and you can find out more information about how to register and get your CLE credit. We're continuing here with hour two of Elimination of Bias. We're a live program today on June 20th, 2016 in Minneapolis. And the last question we got before our lunch break was, who do these language difficulties apply to mostly? And I think what we're going to do, I'm not enough of an expert to answer that question directly, but I can answer kind of a related question. I think we'll flip ahead a little bit to the bottom, the subject heading wound up at the bottom of the page. But at the bottom of the page, it says, page five, it says community and or school liaison officers. We'll figure out what that has to do with anything. So it really starts at the top of page six in your materials. Because that kind of addresses that issue. Now, what do community and or school liaison officers have to do with elimination of bias for attorneys? Well, it's kind of interesting. As I mentioned, probably in 1993, if you did a LexisNexis search for Rochester Somali community, you probably wouldn't get too many hits because there was no such thing as a Rochester Somali community. But one thing that has happened over the last years is that there is now a Rochester Somali community. Large numbers of Somalis have moved to the United States and to Minnesota, and one of the places where a large number of them wound up was Rochester, Minnesota. So there's actually a large Somali community in Rochester these days. And the listening session in Rochester that the Supreme Court held several years ago was actually held at a school. It happened to be the school where many of the Somali parents had kids. So I think maybe there was a little bit of overlap on educational issues versus justice issues. But in any event, one of the issues that they were asked about there was how is there bias in the state legal system? And one of the points that came up was that, well, it would really help if there were better school liaison officers, because the issue that they were really identifying was kind of the issue that you were talking about, and this is a very old issue. So when my grandparents came here from Sweden about 100 years ago, I bet they would have come up with the same issue, and it's a recurring thing. Only the names change, In another 20 years, this will no longer be an issue in the Somali community. But when new immigrants come to America, they're going to have two very different kinds of experiences depending on how old they were when they got here. If you were 18 years or older, or maybe even 12 years or older when you first arrive in America, certainly if you're 30 years old when you first arrive in America, well, then you will never quite totally adjust or never quite totally assimilate into our culture. Because even though you might learn the language well and you might understand the culture well, it will never be your native culture. So no matter what, if you come to the United States or if one of us moved to another country as an adult, you would never adjust completely. You would always be an outsider. The experience of your kids, on the other hand, will be very different, because if you take some kid who speaks no English whatsoever and understands absolutely nothing about American culture, and you plop them into a public school for 13 years, well, even if you tried not to, after 13 years, that kid is going to be just as American as any other kid. And they will understand the language very well. They will understand the culture very well. And they will assimilate. You know, obviously, they're still going to be, have a different experience from somebody who was born here in this country, but they will, it won't be that different, but it will be very different from their parents' experience. Well, that raises an issue for parenting, because suddenly you as a parent don't understand everything that's going on at school. If your kids get involved in the legal system, you don't understand everything that's going on with the legal system. Those are both very foreign systems for you. And but the problem is, your kids do understand those systems. They understand them better than you because they've gone through 13 years of school. And also because they happen to be kids, they think they know everything about it. They think they know more about it than everybody else. So it creates a situation for bad parenting, where your kids actually do know more about the system than you do, and they correctly, that's true, but on the other hand, they also erroneously think that they know everything. Or even if they don't take that added step, the fact still remains that they know more about it than you. So that does not create a very good system for you interacting with the school system or with the legal system. So if the, as I was mentioning to Bill during the break, I get a lot of calls from my kids' school because I have to head down there and sort out some issue that was going on. Well, if I know that system. I know how to interact with the principal. I know how to interact with the teacher. Somebody who doesn't know that system, it's going to be a very, very different experience when that happens. And you put the parent in the uncomfortable position of having to rely on their kid to explain what's going on. So, you know, so in my case, if, you know, I understand what's going on, so I don't have to ask my kid, well, what's going on here? On the other hand, if you're in a situation like that as a parent, and you have to turn to your kid and say, you know, Johnny, what's going on here? And say, oh, no problem at all, Mom. You know, so it's not a recipe for good parenting. And the parents, the Somali parents in Rochester, understand that, and they see that problem. And I'm sure my grandparents 100 years ago, you know, noticed that same issue. You know, 25 years ago, we probably would have been saying that the Hmong were experiencing this. Today, they don't, because this is one of those self-solving problems. After one generation, you don't have to worry about that anymore, because now the Hmong kids in the schools in the Twin Cities, their parents went through that very same system. Cases. So it's a self-correcting problem. But for that first generation of immigrants, it is kind of a serious problem. Yeah.
As you were talking, I was just thinking that I think it also depends on the values of the parents and the children. I'll give you an example. This fellow, Roshi Suzuki, I first met him about 15 years ago. He came here Kawasaki Steel, you know, well-educated, came from a very cultured, educated family in Japan. And he was at the university for a couple of years. And so their three-year-old son, Kentaro, of course, came with him along with Tomoko. And I remember one situation, he was actually helping me install some computer stuff in my office. And he gets this call, and when he gets up the phone, he says, I just talked to the school people. He says, Kentaro bit some kid in the ear, and this kid bit Kentaro back. He says, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. He's got to learn, you know. Now that I think it, I've contrasted that with this American woman who I was representing as a PI client, and her daughter was actually at a camp, and my wife used to be a manager, so I just kind of begged off. But she wanted to sue Eastside Neighborhood Services. And the reason she wanted to sue them was because her child came home with all these mosquito bites. And she thought, wow, they should take care of this problem. You know, the woods are filled with mosquitoes, not to mention around here. But I don't know. So, I mean, just the values issue, I think, can be pretty dramatic. I'm not saying one's right and the other's wrong, but I think you have to kind of recognize those.
Yeah. And before I forget, let me give the next code number, B477. B477. But that raises an important point, because the language, like I say, we can pat ourselves on the back that we've done a good job of supplying interpreters, but language is not the only issue. There's a lot more about it beyond that. There's cultural issues, and there's also nonverbal communication. The different ways things are communicated nonverbally in different languages. So, for example, most of us here in this room have a background as, Anglo-Saxon, white Americans, probably born here. Well, our understanding is, if you want to show respect to somebody else, you look them in the eye. So if I got in some trouble, I parked my car with expired license plates. So I decided to go in and throw myself on the mercy of the court. I want to show respect to the judge when I'm throwing myself on the mercy of the court. And I do that by looking the judge in his eyes and say, "I'm sorry, Your Honor, please, can you throw out the case for this?" And that'll probably work. On the other hand, and that's a pretty much universal way of showing respect to people in our culture. That's not universal, though. So, for example, in some cultures, the way to show respect to somebody is basically to show deference to them. So you don't want to look them in the eye. So instead, I walk into court and say, "Judge, I'm sorry for not having a license plate." Well, it doesn't sound like sincere. It doesn't sound very sincere. It doesn't. It might not show that I'm showing sufficient remorse. So the judge is going to throw the book at me. Whereas that guy right before me, who showed the proper kind of deference, is going to get a different outcome. Yeah. So,
I experienced that in Hawaii. I practiced there. There's a lot of Asians there, and that's exactly right. Don't challenge somebody from a different culture by staring at them forthright. And the deeper the respect, the lower the bow.
Yeah.
There's a direct correlation. So you're right.
Yeah.
And can I just make a comment the other way, too?
Sure.
One of the problems I have with these elimination of bias things is this underlying assumption that all cultures are homogenous. For instance, you raised the look in the eye thing. I didn't grow up that way.
Oh, okay.
I had to learn how to do
okay.
it, and I still have trouble.
Yeah.
It just seems to me to be very disrespectful to be staring at somebody.
Well, yeah.
It's
yeah.
like you're teaching them
yeah,
something.
Yeah, I was exaggerating
so
a certain extent.
That's what, and I find it, when I am dealing with people of other cultures as well, they're not a homogenous group. I may have a Muslim in front of me who does not follow, for instance, the laws of Shia, which are the laws of, inheritance or... They don't care. So you still have to ask the question, do you want to do this or do you not want to,
I really do run the risk of, I'm certainly not saying that that is a risk, because we run the risk of saying, okay, this is the way we white Americans do it. This is the way all those foreigners do it. Divide the world up into two categories like that.
In the Lao community, there are a lot of different individuals that grew up in different villages back home with different attitudes and values. They're not homogenous communities.
Yeah.
The only thing homogenous about them is they may speak the same language with several different dialects.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that easy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it certainly isn't. Yeah, a program like this does run that risk. Yeah, and I guess maybe it all comes back to that first thing. The only thing that will work surefire in every situation is maybe that humility. I mean, maybe it won't work all the time, but that humility of simply asking people, what they believe about something. Because I've had Muslim clients in the past where I was. drawing up a contract for the sale of a business.
Which also has sheer rules, but they may not be following them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so, and I forget what it was in there, but it was kind of, you know, a boilerplate provision in this contract that, in fact, it was even a good idea for tax purposes, but to, you know, to have some interest rate stated. And, or it was, maybe it was even the interest rate in case of default. You know, they would pay X dollars per month, but if, and it didn't even state the interest, but, you know, in the event that it goes into default, you know, interest shall be computed thereupon at the rate of X percent per year. And they said, oh, no, no, we can't do that. Whereas other Muslims probably would not have that objection.
Depending on which sect and how strict they have to interpret their particular use rules,
right.
Which is what that is. But yeah, how are you supposed to know that? The only way is to say, well, okay, what's your objection to that provision?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he read it through and he couldn't have anything in there about interest. And we came up with, I think we came up with something that was, you know, functionally identical for that purpose, because it just called for a certain amount per month, you know, expressed in dollars, and either we removed the interest percentage entirely, or you know, expressed some kind of penalty in terms of dollars or something. So, but it's. That is a real big risk of these programs, kind of the downside of it, that it's just, you know, this is the way we do it, this is the way they do it. So let's start doing it the way they do it. And let's divide the world up into two groups to in order to prove that we're not biased. Well, that probably doesn't work either. So, but in any event, the two groups, I think, that mentioned that, you know, showing deference, were some Asian cultures and some Native American cultures in this particular group. But that was an example that came up in one of them. So I think it was the Native Americans, one group had mentioned that at the listening session in Hinckley. That was one that had come up. So their way, it boils down to their. They communicated something non-verbally in one way, and the judge and the prosecutor and the defense attorney communicated that same thing in another way, which can lead to
misunderstandings. And I think there's a lot of that in the court system, where they assume that there's that old adage that somebody's looking down into one direction, I can't remember which one, they're lying. Well, they may be doing that. They may just not be looking right at you.
Uh-huh.
You know, but they still apply it. Watch them do it.
Yeah. Well, and
it's hard to catch.
Yeah. Well, and we're getting off track a little bit from the written material, so I don't know what page it's on. But one of the areas where that came up in a lot of these programs was bail and sentencing practices. Now, I'm not sure how true those perceptions were, because in Minnesota, I know with sentencing, and I think with bail too, the judge doesn't really have much discretion when it comes to setting sentences and setting bail. In fact, the prosecutor is probably the one maybe that it should be directed to. But when the judge or whoever has to make that decision as to, you know, how are we going to set bail, you know, the judge has to basically analyze that person and say, well, is this person going to show up for trial? Well, if I was doing that, I have a pretty good understanding of what makes an honest person and what makes a responsible person and what makes a reliable person. And I can read that pretty well with somebody. But only if that person is pretty similar to me to start with. So if it was another white middle class person, I can probably judge that other white middle class person pretty fast, because I'll look at what's your family background, what kind of job do you have, you know, by asking some questions, I could probably make a pretty accurate decision of whether or not that person is going to show up for trial. But if that person is from a very different background from me, and I ask those same questions, well, maybe those questions don't work in some other culture, in some other background. So that's where those issues come up. Another place. So, but anyway, the Somali parents in Rochester identified as an issue, you know, this lack of, or the need for a bridge between the two cultures when it comes to interacting with the school, interacting with law enforcement, basically so they don't have to rely on their kids to be translators, which I think every system is smart enough now to realize that you can't do that. Although, you know, there have been times when, Johnny's in trouble and Johnny's parents are there, so that, you know, the court asked Johnny to translate for the parents. Well, he might not get an accurate translation. I think they realize that. But still, the parents don't have anybody to explain that system to them, that their kid understands pretty well, that they do not understand very well. So they were sitting in the school cafeteria in Rochester. So their solution was, well, maybe we should have a Somali speaking officer who's the school liaison officer, so that there's somebody we can speak to that understands not only our language but also our culture. Now, I don't know how practical a solution that would be. Well, maybe it's probably more so now because there probably are Somali graduates of a law enforcement program and probably Somali police officers. 5 years ago, I don't know if that was the case yet. Certainly 10 years from now, there will be a lot of Somali police officers, just as there are many Hmong police officers many people from other groups. So I don't know how practical a solution that is, but that's one solution that they came up with. Just that there's someone, we need to have someone to serve as that cultural liaison between the two systems, whether it's the school or whether it's the court system or whether it's the police, somebody who speaks both languages, not necessarily just English and Somali, but the language of the courts, the language of the police department, the language of the schools, and the language of our culture. So they recognize that need. What that brings up for me, and this is kind of where I conclude the program, sometimes we'll be able to backtrack a little bit. And I forget where it even is in the material here. There is this realization that there is a gap between the two cultures, and what can we do about it? Well, a lot of the things that we're talking about today are really just kind of academic subjects, because you and I as individual attorneys probably can't solve these systems. If we have time when we go back, we'll talk about makeup of jury panels and makeup of the court system, the racial and gender makeup of the bench, questions like that. Well, those are kind of interesting topics, but they're probably not something that you and I have that much of a direct impact on. However, it's occurred to me that this cultural gap between the legal system and immigrant communities who don't necessarily understand the system very well. Well, that is probably something that you and I can nibble away at that problem just as individuals. Just because we are residents of a pretty diverse community, and we deal with different people of different cultures all the time, a lot of times just in passing. And one of the attorneys who took my program pointed out to me something I hadn't thought of, and that is, well, all of us, everyone in this room, I am about 100% certain that within any given week or month, your friends and relatives and neighbors will ask you for free legal advice. It happens all the time. Your friends ask you for free legal advice. Not necessarily areas where you have particular expertise, but on the other hand, when your neighbor has a question about some paper that he got that he doesn't understand, and he wonders what's going on, or he says, well, you know, I was in this car accident. Can I sue the other driver? You know, if he asks Bill that, he'll sign him up right away. If you're not a personal injury lawyer, then you'd say, well, yeah, I think maybe you do have a case. You should probably talk to a personal injury lawyer. But it occurred to me that in that way, we as attorneys kind of serve as a gatekeeping function to the legal profession. A lot of times, kind of just resolving things in a very informal manner. Possibly as simple as telling people, well, no, it's not that big a deal. You don't need to talk about a lawyer about that. Or, you know, if you get one of those notices about a class action thing that's, you know, full of legalese, you know, your neighbor shows it to you and say, oh, no, that just means you'll get 32 cents, you know, minus attorney's fees in 5 years, so you can just throw it away. You know, we serve as that gatekeeping function. So, you know, you are the friendly neighborhood attorney for all of the people on your block, and I'm the friendly neighborhood attorney or the grouchy neighborhood attorney or whatever for all the people in my block. But we serve that kind of gatekeeping function on kind of a routine basis. And there are so many lawyers in the state that it turns out that everybody has a friendly neighborhood attorney that they can turn to. Because for the people in your neighborhood, it's you. You know, for the people in some other neighborhood, some other attorney. But it turns out that there are so many attorneys that everybody either knows an attorney or knows somebody who knows an attorney. Okay, now when your friends ask you for free legal advice, you will grudgingly give it to them, usually, even if it's to say that, you know, talk to another lawyer. But they also know that, you know, turnabout is fair play. So when your neighbor, the doctor, asks you for free legal advice, well, you know that eventually you're going to be going to them for free medical advice. Or your neighbor, the plumber, asks you for free legal advice. Well, you know, you'll tally that up, and you know, the next time you have plumbing questions, well, he's going to give you some free plumbing advice. You know, so it kind of equals out. And everybody, it turns out, has a lawyer in their circle of friends, in their social network, unless you are in a community that has not been in the state long enough to produce any lawyers. So if you're a Hmong American, well, chances are you probably do have a lawyer in your circle of acquaintances. Because your neighbor's grandson, graduated from law school, and he's practicing law. So after, that 20 years or so, you do have that lawyer in your network. On the other hand, more recently arrived immigrant communities probably do not have that. So if you are, and again, this is probably starting to change with respect to the Somali community, because there probably are a growing number of Somali attorneys now. But 5 years ago, or probably even now, there probably aren't that many. So if you were a Somali, well, you probably don't know a lawyer that you can turn to for that kind of informal legal advice. So I guess kind of what I commend all of us to do, even though we can't, change the makeup of the court system on our own, what I commend us to do is to keep those opportunities in mind. Not necessarily marketing opportunities to market your practice, although that's a good way to market your practice. So there's an added benefit for you. But you know, when you go to the gas station and fill up with gas, the guy behind the counter from a different country that you see every day or every week or whatever, well, does that guy know that you're a lawyer? Well, he probably should. Because then suddenly you have worked your way into that network, so that when his friend has a legal issue, they have somebody to turn to for legal advice, even if it's just informal legal advice. Maybe if it's in an area where you don't practice all the time, so that you know, if you don't practice personal injury, but this guy says, "Well, I was injured in a car accident," I say, "Well, here's one of Bill's cards. He's the guy to talk to on that." That is a way to really. I think we can make an actual difference in the world. Let me just. How long have I been talking here? Okay, I've been talking for about half an hour. So we have about 25 minutes to go. I guess I will, let's back up then in the materials. We're kind of taking it way out of order. This is a topic that makes me nervous when I look at this. On page 3, because it says, employ people of color. Well, okay. True confession time. I'm a card-carrying Republican. I'm one of those conservative right-wing people, I look at that and I say, well, wait a minute. They're talking about affirmative action. That's no good. I'm against that. That's my knee-jerk reaction. But there might be a point to it, though, Because this was driven home to me when an African American attorney took my program one day, and he asked me to do this thought experiment. Okay, so I get myself in a little bit of trouble. Maybe I don't pay the fine for that expired license tab or something, and I get myself in a little bit of trouble. I get summoned down to the Ramsey County Courthouse, I have this criminal matter pending against me. I can take solace in the fact that I've been told all my life that we have a fair and impartial court system in this country, and I believe that. So I'm sure I'm going to get a fair trial. So I walk into court. For my court hearing, and sitting up on the bench is the African American judge. I don't think a thing of that. In fact, I very well might not even notice what race the judge is, because a significant percentage of the people who live in my county are African American. So you would certainly expect about that same percentage of people to be judges. So the fact that the judge is African American, that's no big deal at all. But then I start looking around the courtroom, and then I notice the prosecutor over here. Well, there's just another African American over there who's the prosecutor in the case. That's kind of an interesting coincidence. And then my public defender, I look at him, he's African American. And then the jury comes in, and they are all African American. And the bailiff is African American. And the court reporter is African American. I go down to the clerk's office, and the people behind the counter, they're all African American. Well, I don't have anything against any of those individual people whatsoever. I know for a fact that judge is a fair judge. I know that prosecutor is trying to throw me in jail. At least I know that person is fair. My public defender is good. So I can't say anything individually wrong about any of those people. However, eventually I'm going to reach the point where it's just going to kind of creep me out. Something is weird here. Something is wrong here. Because at least 50% of the people in my county have skin the same color as mine. So why is it that none of those people are involved in the process against me? I look around and I realize that I'm the only white person in the room until I turn around and notice the other defendants waiting behind me. And they are all white. Well, there's something wrong with a system like that, because that would freak me out. if that ever happened to me, even though nothing is wrong with any of those individual people. Well, that is the experience of a lot of people in a lot of courtrooms across the state. Now, this observation from Anoka County is several years old, so I'm guessing this has changed a little bit. But they did one of these listening sessions up in Columbia Heights, which just north of here, of course. But that's in Anoka County, which is in the 10th Judicial District, a district with 43 judges. Well, of the 43 judges in the 10th district, 42 of them are Caucasian. So, in other words, the make on the bench is 42 43rds white. Well, I don't know exactly what the exact population breakdown of Anoka County is, but it's probably not 42 43rds white. So there's the makeup of the bench is very different from the makeup of the general population. So in other words, the African-American person who winds up going to court in Anoka County, well, they're going to discover that exactly that scenario that I was talking about, just with the colors flip-flopped. The judge is white, the prosecutor is white, the public defender is white, the bailiff is white, the court reporter is white, the people in the clerk's office are white. He's the only black person in the room with the exception of the other black defendants. So even though there's nothing exactly wrong with any of those people, just the overall system, at the very least, it's going to convey a perception of unfairness. So now, again, I'm a card-carrying Republican, and we are opposed to, affirmative action. So, how can I be saying all these things? Well, This African American attorney who took my program reassured me when I said that. He said, "Well, wait a minute, you're not talking about affirmative action, because affirmative action, that thing that I'm against, well, affirmative action is that's somebody coming in from outside and saying you have to appoint this person because of their race, or you have to appoint this person because of their gender." And I'm against that because I think the most qualified person should be in any particular position. But on the other hand, maybe the makeup of the bench, the makeup of the court staff, the makeup of the attorneys in the state, maybe that is one of the things that makes you the most qualified person. And I guess two examples I can give of that are two recent judges, one of them, like I mentioned, passed away recently, Justice Wall of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Well, she was the first female judge appointed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and she was appointed by Governor Perpich, and she was, and I don't know exactly when this was, I think it was like the mid-70s or so where she was appointed. And Governor Perpich got a fair amount of criticism for that appointment by saying, "Well, wait a minute, she was not the most qualified person for the job. You should have appointed the most qualified person for the job." Well, time has proven that criticism wrong, because she turned out to be, I think one of the great judges of the 20th century. Another one, very, very different politically, was Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the U.S. Supreme Court. She was appointed by President Reagan in, the early 1980s or so, and she was also subject to some of that same criticism, or he was subject to that same criticism for appointing her, because the criticism was, "Well, wait a minute, she was not the most qualified person for the job. You only appointed her because she was a woman. That was the wrong thing to do." Well, time has proven that criticism wrong, because I also think that she was one of the greatest judges of the 20th century. Well, how could that be? Because she clearly wasn't the most qualified person for the job. She never sat on the First Circuit Court of Appeals. She never went to Harvard or Yale. I think at one point she was elected to the Arizona legislature, but she was Her highest ranking position was to the Intermediate Court of Appeals in Arizona. Well, it's not very often that the President of the United States goes to an intermediate appellate court in a Western state to appoint somebody. You know, the customary place to pick judges is from the First Circuit or maybe the High Court of New York or California or something. So clearly she lacked that kind of objective qualification, yet she proved to be a good judge. Well, the fact is, the thing that made her a good judge was exactly the fact that she was different from the other judges on the court. I think the Supreme Court has a real problem now with lack of diversity, not having anything to do with the color of anybody's skin or their religion or their gender or anything, or certainly not their political views, but they all went to the same schools. Well, you know, they all went to Harvard or Yale, and they were all on the First Circuit, and it's this this tiny little club. If today, let's say today that President Obama or I can't even say it, President Trump appoints a judge. If they appoint somebody from the Arizona Court of Appeals or the Minnesota Court of Appeals, that pick would just be laughed at because that person is not the most qualified person. But having that kind of diversity just of backgrounds, I think, is more important than that's the thing that makes you the most qualified person. Graduating from Harvard is not the thing that makes you the most qualified person, because it's easy to find nine smart people at Harvard and put them on the Supreme Court. That doesn't take too much work. So I think what it boils down to, and how I've kind of resolved this issue in my mind, is that well, I guess fortunately I'm not governor and I don't have to make this choice, but if I'm the governor and I'm picking a vacancy to sit on the Minnesota Supreme Court or the Minnesota District Court, well, one of the things that makes that person the most qualified could very well be the fact that he matches, or she matches, the racial and gender makeup of the community, and maybe even a little bit of diversity. Like, well, maybe they didn't go to the best law school, but the smartest lawyer in some other law school. So I've kind of come around on that issue, and I guess I can still say I'm against affirmative action because I really think you should have the most qualified person for any job. But you have to expand on what makes them the most qualified. Yeah.
You got to decide, well, when it comes to judges, what qualifications are you looking for? To me, that's kind of a key issue. Because you can have a lot of disagreement, I think, over the term qualifications.
Well, yeah, and the easy way to solve that problem is to say, well, we'll just take the smartest lawyer from the best law school who was at the highest court previously. So we'll have the guy who was number one in his class from Harvard gets the next position no matter what.
Well, I don't think there's ever been any president that would say that was the number one position.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
I know of that, right?
Well, that makes an easy recommendation, though, because that way you don't have to worry about the Senate criticizing you because the person is just a woman from Arizona.
I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah.
It obviously gets into politics.
Well, yeah.
It gets into many different factors.
Yeah. But those same factors seem to apply on both sides of the aisle, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat president appointing it, because they know the other side is going to criticize them no matter what. So just to remove that objection from the table, we'll get the smart person from Harvard who was on the First Circuit, and then at least we've dispensed with that argument. But again, I'm a little bit troubled that we have lack of diversity on the Supreme Court, not so much race or gender or even political viewpoints, because there's certainly a lot of diversity in that area. So So anyway, and of course that, speaking of judges, that applies to court staff as well. Probably applies to attorneys. I've turned around a little bit on that. It looks like we have about 10 more minutes. Does anybody else have any questions or comments? Otherwise, I'll pick out another area to. I'll kind of conclude with kind of a weird issue that you think, well, what does this have to do with the courts and everything? And that is public transportation. So we're out here. We have the light rail out here right now. What does public transportation have to do with anything? Well, one of these listening sessions was held at the Dakota County Jail. Because if you want to find people who have experiences interacting with the court system, what better place to find them than the jail? Because every person there has experiences with the court system. So they held one listening session at the Dakota County Jail, and it turned out the most of the reaction they got from people there was no different than the ones that they got from people in church basements. They said pretty much the same thing, except one issue came up there, and that was that it turns out that most residents of the Dakota County Jail believe that they are there for one reason and one reason alone. And is that because they are criminals? Well, no. What they believe is that they are in jail because of the lack of public transportation to the Dakota County Government Center. It might have something to do with the fact that they're criminals too, but they have a little bit of a point because let's say I decide to go out for a night of drunken driving around the Twin Cities. I'm careening around, wreaking havoc, and eventually I get pulled over, except I get pulled over in, Burnsville or Apple Valley or something as I'm, going through, going by on 494. Suddenly the most important place in the world for me is now Hastings, Minnesota, or maybe Apple Valley, since they have a courthouse there too. Eventually they send me home with a piece of paper saying that I have to report to courtroom number so-and-so in Hastings on Monday morning at 8 o'clock. And they also tell me I don't have a driver's license anymore. I can't drive a car. Well, they took my car away from me. So suddenly here I am, I have to be in Hastings at 8 o'clock in the morning, on Monday morning, or Tuesday morning, or whatever, and I don't have a car. I don't know exactly how you would get to Hastings on the bus. It's probably theoretically possible. You might be able to theoretically get there on Friday evening, but it's basically impossible. You can't do it. I throw my arms up in despair, and eventually a warrant gets issued for my arrest, and eventually somebody picks me up, and I wind up in the Dakota County Jail. And then while I'm there in the Dakota County Jail, I lament that there's only one reason why I'm here, and that's because there's no bus to Hastings. Well, now, it's easy for us to dismiss that, because if I had to be in court in Hastings on Monday morning at 8 o'clock and I didn't have a car, I would certainly figure out a way to get there because I'm a responsible kind of person. In fact, that has even happened to me before. I had a court appearance in Anoka County, and I go out to the car to drive up to Anoka, and click, the car doesn't start. So suddenly I'm in a position where I have to be in Anoka in an hour and I don't have a car and you certainly can't get there on the bus. So I had to start running around scrambling, asking people for a ride. And finally I think I borrowed somebody's car and I got there. So, you know, I'm a responsible kind of person, so I deal with that. So, yeah, I mean, so it's easy to say, well, we can't just coddle these criminals and, you know, worry about that issue. But on the other hand, it's something we ought to at least give some thought to. So now if you're building a new government center in Dakota County, there are only a certain number of places you can put the thing. You know, in the cornfield on the outskirts of town is probably about the only place you can put the thing, so it's not necessarily going to be very convenient. But I guess, you know, if you're ever a planner for such things, whether you're a planner for where to put the new courthouse or where to run your bus lines, well, you should probably at least give the matter some thought, because you know, it's not just a matter of killing criminals, because other people have business that they have to transact at the courthouse, and you want to have them have a way to get there with you know, kind of a minimum of difficulty anyway. So it's something you should give some thought to. And in fact, when I gave the program one time in Eau Claire, sometimes they give this program out of state because they're Minnesota attorneys, but they were just in the process of building a new courthouse, and sure enough, you know, it was way outside of town, and that was one of the issues, that, well, how are people going to get to the new courthouse, especially if they don't have a car? So it's an issue. You know, I don't know if that's a soluble issue, but it's certainly.
I think we could just get rid of the notion that everything has to go to the district court and put traffic courts in cities where people are picked up. You know, if you get ticketed in Burnsville, you go to a Burnsville traffic court for these minor little things.
Yeah.
There's really no need to have these big, huge judicial proceedings.
So the illustration you gave was he's out drunk and driving. That's not just traffic.
Work. Yeah. Well, yeah.
But, you know, it's a specialty. There's no reason it couldn't be put in that area.
Well, yeah. The
Hastings is a hell of a long way to go from Burnsville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, in fairness, there is a courthouse in Apple Valley.
Yes, but most of the things that a lot of people have to do aren't at that courthouse.
Okay. And
there's very little you can actually do in Apple Valley.
Okay. Well, and can you get to the Apple Valley courthouse on the bus?
In theory, if you're willing to ride for 2 or 3 hours.
Okay. So it's not much better. Yeah, the
you can get to the malls.
Okay.
Well, then don't you think it's really a matter of societal priorities? In other words,
it is.
Let's just take your Hastings example. I mean, I don't know what the bus service is between Minneapolis and downtown Hastings, but let's assume that there's some bus service. Maybe there's not. There isn't, then that's another
maybe thing. Greyhound.
What I'm thinking is that you take the nearest city where there is some bus service to these larger metropolitan areas, and then from there you provide a court shuttle service free of charge.
That would do it too, as long as people
don't
exist.
Well, you have to obviously do some marketing, but I mean, I'm thinking, I went on vacation. I'm used to go on vacation at Outer Banks in North Carolina. And they had these rental places, they were just kind of dispersed. But then they were trying to promote this big recreation center where they gave tennis lessons and everything. Plus they had a swimming pool. They provided it free of charge. They had their little bus, and you could pick it up every half an hour. So if they can do it there, they can certainly do it.
But they
can
also
like
disperse this as well. We have driver's license bureaus all over the place. They're not all run by the state. But they're out there, and you're within 6-7 miles anywhere in Minnesota of a driver's license bureau, unless you live up in the Arrowhead. But it's not that hard. You just have to restructure your darn system. And the only reason that Hastings is out there is traditionally that was the county seat for Dakota, so all business goes out there. And Burnsville didn't exist, as a real community at the time. They're just hanging on to that tradition. We have to be in Hastings.
Mm-hmm. Well, now they have the big building, so you have to use it for something.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I believe we're almost up to our two-hour mark, so just let me give the final code number. It's B498 is the last of the four code words. And I'll just I'll sign off here with the podcast. Please... You can email to clem.law@usa.net. The code numbers were given during the program for your certificate of attendance. And thanks for joining us today.
So, you know, we've got the